Welcome to Neuromovement Revolution with Anat Benyel, where you will discover breakthrough possibilities for your life through the brain's power to change. We're so happy that you can join us in making the impossible possible.
Hi, everybody. It is so good to be with you again. We have a really great treat for you today, for all of us. I have with me Dr. Richard Miller. Richard is a world-renowned spiritual teacher, author, yogic scholar, researcher, and clinical psychologist. He has combined traditional yogic practice with Western psychology and neuroscience. He is the founder of iRest, a meditation practice based on the ancient tradition of yoga nidra and adapted to suit the conditions of modern life. Richard says, when practiced regularly, a little and often, iRest enables you to meet each moment of your life with unshakable peace and well-being, no matter how challenging or difficult your situation. I know Richard for a good number of years now, and Richard is remarkable, and he's done amazing work with the veterans, and he'll tell you more. And aside from wanting you guys to know, if you don't already know of Richard and his work, to be introduced to it, I asked Richard to come and do this podcast with me today for an hour. We have a whole hour, which is fantastic. Richard's understanding of humans and behaviors and the different states of well-being. Richard has worked a lot with post-traumatic stress disorder and how he goes about facilitating for people to get better, I feel is very relevant for parents of children with special needs, and actually for the children themselves, or at least to be aware that children also can have a trauma response to their experiences. We're getting to the holidays, and I thought it'd be a great, great gift to give people some of your wisdom and some of your tools. And so welcome for being here.
Thank you.
A little formal here.
It's lovely being here with you. And as you say, we've known each other for years now. We're in a monthly group, and
yes.
Also just love being with one another.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, Richard, one of the things I realized quite a few years back that we work with different populations, but we work a lot with children with special needs. And my background is clinical psychology, too. So I realized after working with children for a while that the parents are traumatized. And they have post-traumatic stress disorder response because this is how the brain does it. What's the name of the woman that wrote Trauma in Recovery book many years ago? Judith Herrmann.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I was introduced to the concept. And one of the things I loved about what she wrote in the book is that it's not like you have a weak or bad character or something is wrong with you. The brain is built under the right conditions and sufficient stress, everybody will have that response.
Yeah, as you say, when we're under inescapable stress.
Yes.
And it could be from having a special needs child. It also could be working in an office where the phone never stops ringing, or where a lot of my work, as you say, has been with veterans, and a lot of the healthcare workers in the amputee ward, the burn unit, in the hospitals, they have, we might call it vicarious PTSD from working with the injured veterans, or I work with homeless and women who've been rescued from human trafficking. There are many ways we can experience what we might call stress, and then post-traumatic stress, and then that can go into what we might call a post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. For most people, I think it is it's a stress response. It's natural in the body, and we might call it then a post-traumatic stress when we're not able to escape it and we're not able to, in a way, process it sufficiently, and then there's just an ongoing buildup. And then we'll see things like disturbances in sleep, disturbances in the way we handle our social relationships. People then may opt for self-medication in different ways, whether it's alcohol, different drugs, or different escape mechanisms. But I think of it as all these different ways we're trying to survive through difficult circumstances. And again, I'd like to reinforce what you're saying. It's a natural response. When the body's under undue duress, whether it's short-term or long-term, the body is adapting to survive through the circumstance so that ultimately it can come back and heal back through the stress and eliminate it out of the system.
Yeah, and I think I just want to clarify, because when you say the body, for me, and I believe you are exactly the same way, I don't separate in my perception and understanding of us, you, me, a person. Mm-hmm. It's the emotional, very much the emotional, it's the ideational, it's the involuntary thoughts or images that keep coming back, or dreams. So it all is housed in the body.
It's housed in the body. So the initial stress response might be from a circumstance where we're left with a strong image, memory, a strong emotion, for some people, it's just a bodily sensorial response that's pre-verbal, non-cognitive. So I agree with you. It can operate on all these levels. And I'm aware that when we experience, say, an emotion, mm-hmm. it's a physical response in the body. When we have a memory, an image, a thought, it is a physical response in the body.
Yes. Oh, it's always the whole system.
So it's an integrated,
absolutely.
We both agree. It's an integrated system.
So two things. I want to tell the people that are listening that you are invited to ask questions. They can be, if you agree, mm-hmm. personal questions.
Absolutely.
or about you, about your child, about approaches, whatever comes to you that you would like to ask. And Neil is here with us, except we don't have space for three people. So Neil is on the side because they love having Neil on this podcast. And so that's ask the questions. And then maybe if it's okay for you, when we got ready and discussed about doing this podcast, it was the first time I learned that one of your children had special needs.
Yes.
So maybe you want to tell the parents a little bit your experience and how you grew and dealt with it.
Yeah. With the birthing of our second child, it's about 3 or 4 months before he was to be birthed, we found out that he had hydrocephalus. And we were informed the doctors didn't know whether he would be born totally healthy, whether he would be brain damaged, whether he would die at birth, or we would have a totally disabled child. It was an extraordinary experience for me because my mind, my thought processes just went totally wild. For about 2 weeks, I hardly slept. I, in a way, stopped eating. When I look back on it, what I realized was my psyche was searching out every image that I had unconsciously or consciously built of the life that I would have with my future son. And I was, in a way, ripping up every one of those images for those 2 weeks. And at the end of 2 weeks, it felt like I had ripped up the final image or projected hope or desire. And my mind went totally quiet. Mm-hmm. And I realized I was now open to the unknown and not knowing what would be happening and really willing to be with whatever. When he was born, We did end up having him have surgery at 1 month. I put a shunt in. And for the next, 18 years, I would say, but especially those first young years until he was about 12, you know, every year we had an MRI. We were on constant heightened alert because some of the symptoms of the failure of a shunt, as some of our viewers may know, are a cough, a cold, a headache, a gentle malaise of some kind, a flu. So that flu and cold symptoms mimicked the failure of a shunt. So we were always on heightened alert. So there was I would say my wife and I for years were under this kind of ongoing stress response. You know, the long term, I think we are one of the fortunate parents, and my son is a fortunate human being in that he never had to have subsequent surgeries, where we know many of his compatriots who did get shunts had 5, 10, 12 revisions of their shunt. And we learned many, many years later that the doctors feel that probably when he was in his late teens or early 20s, the shunt actually failed because the body had made up for what originally was the hydrocephalus.
So how do you mean the body made up?
Sometimes when a person has hydrocephalus, for him, and the viewers may not know, there are four ventricles, two on either side of the brain, a third that corresponds and opens into the spinal fluid, and then the spinal fluid would be the fourth ventricle. For his hydrocephalus, the third ventricle that corresponds between the brain and the cerebral spinal fluid never opened. It was shut. So the brain fluid was building up and had no way to escape. The shunt was placed so it could take the fluid out of the brain and bring it down into the abdomen, and the abdomen would absorb it. What they feel somehow along the way, and this happens, what we've come to discover often, more often than we might think, somehow the body opened that third ventricle or found a new way of absorbing that cerebral spinal fluid. So he's in a way shunt free now. We don't go in and remove a shunt because you don't want to disturb
what's already gone. And you don't want to open the head if you don't have to.
Correct. So yeah, there is still that long-term possibility of something could happen because of the original hydrocephalus. But he's gone on to have a wonderfully successful career. And there were challenges along the way because hydrocephalus can delay certain developmental processes. So we had to work with that and with him. It can lead to different emotional responses. So we had a lot to work with, and we just took it as, here's our son. Here's what we've been given. How do we work with these emotions? How do we work with these developmental delays? And how do we support him as best we can, seeking professional help and just guidance, and really setting him free to become the human being that we feel he was meant to be, not imposing how we feel he should be, but really setting him free.
So, you know, I was going to come back to it anyway, just from the beginning of your story. So first of all, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think this can be very important and meaningful for parents. And some parents are at the beginning of the road. Mm-hmm. Some parents might be further along, but maybe not quite with the same, you know, positive outcomes relative to the expectations. Right. So I'm going to kind of shine the light on, you know, in my work, I have those nine essentials, the conditions to optimize brain plasticity, positive brain change, basically. And one of them is flexible goals.
Yes.
So it's like you have the goals, you have the desires, you have the visions, but you dance with it in relation to the here and now and to the unknown. So living in the world of possibilities without certainties. And you said that you, like, for 2 weeks you ripped one image of potentially lost dream and another lost projection and another lost projection.
And I'd like to be clear, I didn't. I wasn't doing it.
It was doing it for
you. It was just this mechanism that got set off in my internal process just basically went
wild. Yeah, so it was spontaneous, yeah, and intense. And so this is one probably of the hardest things, and understandably so, for parents to arrive at in a real, real deep way. Mm-hmm. So you may want to say more about that. And do you have any practical, like, little exercise mm-hmm. you can take the audience through?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Me too, and probably Neil. Or Neil has to. Do we have any questions already?
A couple of comments, but I think remind people, because there's a little bit of a delay to
yes.
get the questions, so if you remind people to
yeah.
ask.
So if you can ask the question, if you have questions you want to ask after the exercise, we'll come back to the comments and questions, and the floor is yours.
You use this word connection.
Yes.
My word, and like you have your nine
thingies,
and I have my 10 thingies. These to me are core principles that I find are inherent within us, but we may not have learned as children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of these kinds of principles that you
yes.
have and I have as innate within us, but we may not have gotten the owner's manual as a child
yes.
of how to access them.
And
we may not have grown up in a family setting or a culture that really supported learning these principles, so in an embodied way. The word that I use along with connection is welcoming. We're learning how to welcome the moment and what it is bringing into our lives in such a way that we're able to respond rather than be reactive to it. And one of the principles behind what I think of as welcoming entails really tuning into the body so that all the information that we're getting from the outside, that the doctors may be telling us, our child may be sending to us in their behaviors, people around us are giving us information, but also our own visceral emotional response, cognitive response, thought processes. We're learning in a way how to welcome these, which come often with images, thoughts, memories. And something I think it really helped me understand, and I teach this a lot, and I know you know these principles as well, but when we get caught in a particular cognitive thought loop, and it could be a series of judgments, or what did I do wrong? Because I mean, my wife and I, when we discovered our child has hydrocephalus, one of the thoughts that occurred to us, I mean, what did we do wrong? Were we responsible for this? So we can have all sorts of negative thoughts, and we can get caught in these loops. And
we have also a certain percentage of the audience, the listeners, are there for themselves. So
yes.
they may have Parkinson's or severe pain.
Right.
Or
so we
like
can
that.
Get caught in our own belief systems
yeah.
or thoughts about the implications of what we're experiencing. So in my life, I've had periods of tremendous chronic pain, which I've had to work with and work through. But one of the things I've come to appreciate is we can get caught in a particular part of our nervous system, this what we call the default network, where we're in a particular cycle of looping thoughts we feel we can't get out of, or we feel like we're being hijacked by a particular emotion, whether it's fear, anxiety, sadness, depression. We can get caught in these loops. We have these wonderful approaches that you engage, I engage, that help break us out of these default networks in our nervous system and place us in a whole new ability to access information we otherwise can't access, and to be open to this possibility of connecting at a deeper level and having this ability to be with and open to the possibilities that might be here that we otherwise can't recognize. So one of the exercises I like taking people through is to, as quickly as we can, recognize that no matter what we're experiencing or our child is experiencing. That's happening to the body and to the mind, but there's another part of ourselves that I like to say can't be harmed, injured, doesn't need fixing, changing. I call it a quality of wholeness that we all have innate within us, and I know you know this. What I want people to recognize as quickly as possible is there's something about us that doesn't need fixing, wasn't injured, or is not being injured and doesn't need healing. If we can connect to that and recognize that in our child or the person that we're with, whether it's our mate, a spouse, or a friend, we're relating then to two aspects about them. One is this place within them that is already whole, healthy, and doesn't need healing. Then we can look at the body and the mind and what does need healing. And this quality of wholeness is innate within all of us, but it can get pushed into the background and usurped by the emotions and the circumstances. So let me take us through just a little quick exercise and see if we can begin to tune in and touch into this essence that I might call this wholeness of being. One of the things we want to do is shift from our thinking mind more to a somatic experiencing. So take a moment as you're listening.
It's okay to close the eyes.
Absolutely.
Feel free except if somebody listening to it driving, right. Then you don't close
feel your free eyes. To keep your eyes open or to close your eyes, and at any time feel free to open or close your eyes. So take a moment, however you are, whether you're driving, sitting in a chair, or walking around your room. Let your senses open so you welcome the different sounds that are around you. The sense of the environment, coolness or warmth that's present on your skin. And attune to your physical body. It's like take your attention and let it roam freely for a moment around your body without trying to constrain it. And just notice how attention, when it's set free, moves about spontaneously. Take a moment and do that. Notice how attention will move to a sound or a sensation. And it might register an emotion, another sensation, sound, or a thought. We're not trying to change or fix anything. We're just setting attention free to welcome the body. And then as best you can, feel down, we might say, down through your shoulders. Notice what might be happening first in your jaw, then your shoulders, shoulder blades. The natural sensation of weight or lightness in your arms and hands. And sensing the breath, the natural coming and going of exhalation, inhalation. You might notice the natural movement of the chest or belly. And any sensations that are present in the hips, pelvis, legs, feet. Then bring attention into the hands and rest momentarily in one hand so that you're welcoming the sensations in the palm and fingers. Natural sensations of weight or heaviness. You might begin to perceive sensations like a throb or a vibratory quality, warmth, or coolness. Then gently shift attention into the opposite hand and notice the sensations in the palm, fingers. Then welcome the sensation of both hands at the same time. And notice as you're doing this, we're shifting away from thinking into simply perceiving the body as sensation. Your mind may begin to name a particular sensation as comfortable, uncomfortable, sharp, dull. But as much as you can, let the label go and just welcome the body as sensation. And as best you can, let yourself settle into what I call a moment of simply being, where we're between two doings. Even though we may be driving at the moment, we've left where we were, we haven't arrived yet. We're in this moment of simply being here. And in this moment of simply being, you might notice where and how you experience yourself in your body. Many people report as they settle into a simple ease of being, they feel it in their heart or their belly. So I support you to let attention drop more into your heart, your belly, so you're sensing from this part of your body. And notice how your simple sense of being, there's a quality of presence about it. There's something about ourselves we can't deny when we don't think. We feel a sense of our own presence. And notice how when you sense your presence, it has both a localized felt sense about it in your belly, heart, or other parts of your body. But many people report how it also has a more field-like quality to it. That when we inquire into where exactly is our felt sense of presence, you can feel it as a localized sense in the body, but also more as a field that extends in front, behind, left, and right. So notice in this moment, if you open attention so it's equally in front and behind you, to your left and right, so attention is more global or more like a surrounding field that includes and encompasses the body and the environment you're in. And your quality of presence, how your thinking mind may begin to slow down a bit. And we can inquire when you're simply being and feeling your own presence, does this quality of presence lack or need or want for anything, or is it okay just as it is, even as your body may still need or want for sleep or food, shelter, breathing, clothing? But the simple sense of being, when we really settle into it, we might begin to perceive how it's something that's outside lack, need, or want. It's okay just as it is. And how this simple sense of being, we may not spend much time in our life nourishing it, but it's available to us at any time, no matter what else is present. So you might let attention roam about again freely and notice the environment around you and sounds. And this underlying ease of being. Or notice a particular emotion that might be present, where and how you feel it in the body. And this simple ease of being can be here at the same time. You might notice a particular thought you're having, and how the simple sense of being can equally be present, whether a thought is present or absent. So take a moment. If your eyes have been closed, you might let them open. If your eyes are open, if it feels right, you can close them and open them several times. And what I like to say is nourish this felt sense of being into your eyes open, waking state of consciousness. And our exercise here now is to continue to do this little and often throughout our day, and in periods of time when we're doing what we're doing right now, where we set aside what we're doing and really anchor into this felt sense of being. This, when we really touch into it, gives us a ground and a foundation from which we can meet any thought, experience, emotion, circumstance, whether it's inside our body, some process that we're going through, or it's a circumstance outside of us that feels out of our control. We have a ground that we can develop that gives us a sense of foundation from which to meet any circumstance. And as we feel more and more into being, we can recognize that being itself can't be hurt, harmed, injured, doesn't need fixing, changing. And actually, when we really nourish being over a long period of time, little and often, it ushers forth profound inner experiences of a sense of well-being, an unbreakable sense of joy, so that we could be depressed, sad, fearful, and yet there's something in us that still feels a sense of well-being and joy. Joy and well-being, paradoxically, can be present whatever else we might be experiencing. I've worked with so many veterans, homeless, people with severe emotional aspects like depression that they've had for years. And when we sit together and over a period of about 20 or 30 minutes, I can help them feel into this ground of being. They feel how it breaks through the circumstances, gives them a glimpse of a deeper understanding that now they can bring with them to whatever the circumstances are.
That's fabulous.
And then we're building off of this with all the other tools of then how do we work with emotions and thoughts when they are present. But I really like to work out of this ground of being. So we're not healing or doing our work to get to our sense of wholeness. We are actually working from our sense of wholeness. And then we're looking at our children or ourselves from the eyes of wholeness, not looking at them as something's wrong with them, or something's wrong with me. Now I can say, yeah, there's something wrong with the body, or there's something wrong with the nervous system, but they're wholeness in themselves.
This is beautiful. You know, a few things. So I'm thinking about my work, and I think just lucky or fortunate that when I started working first with adults, but with the children, it was the most clear to me because, you know, they bring a little child in and there's all the diagnosis and prognosis and anxiety, and the kid is like this or like that, or they need to be helped to breathe. So it's obviously something is really wrong, mm-hmm. or emergency or so on and so forth. But I always, from the beginning, always, see the child, connect to the being, the person in there. So I actually don't see anything wrong. I mean, the word wrong does not attach.
Right.
I see what is. That means I see that the child is having a hard time with this or is trying unsuccessfully to do that. But it's not wrong. It's just what it is. And then, of course, another aspect of it, which, never mind the whole story, how that I experienced the first time, and then I adopted it intentionally onwards, working with adults and children, is that the more wrong or cookie the organization is, the more brilliant, in a certain way, I think the nervous system is. Because if it can function within that and still look for a path to do things or connect or think or so on. So kids on the autism, you know, it's like when I see what is not working quite right for them, but they still can fill in the blank, I say, well, that's a very, very capable nervous system that has a interference that we want to help. So that part is for me very obvious, and that's something that some parents have easier time to get to and some have a little harder. But doing it to the self, I find a lot harder. So doing it in interaction, being there with another, I find almost self-evident. But when I go, so they, never mind the content, but I had the call that was a bit stressful and gave me news that I wasn't so happy with. And I was doing your exercise and I could feel it's like 12 horses trying to pull me into my, and then I hear your voice and I go and my left hand feels so much bigger than the right hand, which I couldn't connect, you know, thinking and feeling. Anyway, and all that stuff. So can you talk about those 12 horses thingy?
So I like to start as much as I can, help a person feel this ground of being, just touch it a little bit. But now we've got these 12 horses we got to deal with. So I have a series of, again, I call them steps or tools that I talk about in my writings and the teachings, where we're learning how to, say, relax the body. We're learning how to build in a relaxation response into the body in the midst of a stress response. So this is where
so
I might say,
concrete.
Like when I was doing this exercise, I said, so take a moment, what's happening in your jaw? When we bring attention to the jaw, people might see that it's clenched and there'll be a gradual softening. Or then we'll say, so what's happening right now in the shoulders? And all of a sudden they drop their shoulders because it was all scrunched up. Or what's happening in the palms of the hands? And all of a sudden they become unclenched. So body sensing, learning how to, in a way, bring in a relaxation response in the midst of stress is one of the tools. You talked about the breath. So there's a moment where we attune to the breath. We're not trying to change it. We're first joining with it, welcoming it. And what we see is anytime we allow something to be just as it is, its grip, although we might feel it first as a grip, like you said, one of these 12 horses that are trying to pull you away, if we really just take a moment and feel into it, it'll start to relax its grip. Because I like to think that we as human beings, you know, we have these needs for food, shelter, clothing, safety, social. But I believe we have four other, or actually five other needs to be seen, heard, connected to, belong. And I think a fifth one, which is to realize that innate wholeness. That we're all driven to try to understand it. So if that's a primary need of us, and if I've upset you in some way and you're angry and I come to you, what do you want? You want to be heard, seen, connected with. And if you really feel I'm connecting with you, your anger will dissipate and now we can talk. And the same thing, if I'm upset, that's what I want. I want to feel seen and heard. So I think of the child or anything within us, an emotion, a thought, a body sensation, they're also wanting to be seen, heard,
connected.
That's
a sweet way of saying it.
And
that's
really
the welcoming. I like the welcoming. And I guess sort of build a sense of safety, allowing to feel, because part of it is trying to just...
And your image of a wild horse, I think, is really a good image, a metaphor, because if we have a wild horse, we're not going to try to rope it. We're going to give it enough room to move, but with some boundaries, we might say. And then, as one friend of mine does, he's actually a horse whisperer. he will actually bring a chair into the corral and he just sits in the chair. And there's a wonderful story because he was hired by a particular person, he told me. And for a whole week, he just sat in the corral in a chair with this wild horse.
And the person thought that he was just doing nothing.
Correct. And he was starting to get really mad because he was paying him all this money. But after about 5 or 6 days, the horse, realizing that he wasn't a threat, started coming over and then finally nudged him and smelled him. And that's
and
when
looked
he
for connection.
And
yeah.
looked for connection. And that's when he knew he had the horse. Yeah. Yeah. So
I do that with the chair.
Yeah. yeah. And so
I can usually do it a lot faster.
Yeah. So can we do it when we have a wild horse emotion, a wild thought, a wild body sensation like pain or numbness or whatever's going on? Can we first notice it and in a way let it feel seen, heard, connected with? I've never found a human being that I've worked with, and including myself, that likes to be fixed or changed.
And it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I hate that when I come to somebody and I say, you know, can I have a few minutes of your time? I've got something going on. And they say, sure. And then they immediately try to help fix or change. It just shuts everything down. So if we're having a strong emotion or a strong thought or memory, first thing we want to do is learn how to welcome it, sense it, let it be seen, heard, and let it relax and lose its grip a bit.
So let's go. Do we have any questions and comments? But I'll just say that to translate it, and then let's see what people are bringing to us, that whatever a parent feels in relation to the child, and the feelings can vary all the way from intense commitment, love, dedication, mm-hmm. to moments of, as I used to say to my daughter when she was very little, and she, you know, whatever she did, and I was besides myself, and I used to say to her, you're so lucky God gave you such a sweet face. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm going to kill this girl.
Well,
right?
One of the things I used to do with my son when he would get really upset, because he was struggling in his own life with the things that he couldn't do because he wanted to do them, but with the hydrocephalus, we said, no, I'm sorry, you can't do that because of the potential for injury. He would get really upset, and I would say, you know, would you like to talk to me about it? And he'd say, no. And so I'd sit with him a little while, and then I'd say, so you don't really want to do this right now? And he'd say, no. And I'd say, great. I said, I'm going to leave, but I'll be back.
Yeah.
And then about 20 minutes, I'd come back again and I'd say, are you ready to talk back? He said, no. So I'd say, I'll be back.
That's like what they did with the horse.
Right.
Yes.
And so that's to me what I'm doing with the remote. We keep coming back.
Yeah, but I'm talking about parents from the inside to make room to have because it can be very scary.
Well, I'm doing that with my emotion. I'm saying, I'll be back over and over again.
Okay.
Befriending it, not trying to attack it or change it or say that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. But how do I open to the visceral, somatic, felt sense of the emotion and then slowly begin to unpack it a little bit at a time, not assault it?
Okay. Neil is at the ready.
Coming a little bit closer so I can be heard. First of all, a couple of comments. Brain Body Vitality Center, thank you, Anat and Dr. Miller. I look forward to learning from you both. And then from Nedi Safar, thank you for acknowledging the relentless stress of having a child who at any moment might run away or hurt himself. We have a question from Anna Maria Pardo. How can we extend the practices you describe to an intentional community? How can we support each other in ways that call to each other's wholeness, besides ABM, of course, she says with a smiley face.
From my organization, the IRIST Institute, we offer online programs, in-person programs, where we try to bring people together in community.
Wonderful.
And help in community learn how to work with these different tools, we might call, how do we work with an emotion? How do we work with a thought, a strong body sensation? And we teach the tools. Then we have people experience the tools one by one. So there's a kind of an incremental, slow learning process. But then I love to put people into dyads, into one-to-one where I'm learning how to listen. And there's a book that I read when I was beginning my work as a psychotherapist, and it was for children, and it was called How to Listen So Kids Will Talk, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen. Well, I translated that in my work with adults and couples, how to talk so my partner will listen and how to listen so my partner will talk. Mm-hmm. I think these are skills that we all need to learn in a skillful way. And by having people sit together in dyads with different questions or inquiries that I ask them to do, and in our, say, in some of our online learning programs, we have a level one training where my compatriot who I'm teaching with, we actually do a dyad. And we show, how do we meet a sensation when we're working with another? How do we meet them out of their emotions? How do we meet them out of their thoughts? And then how do we do that back and forth in a conversational kind of way? Because I like to say, we're always in a dyad. Mm-hmm. We're always here with ourselves, talking to ourselves. And we could say, and I ask people sometimes, find a mirror, sit in front of it and have a dialogue with yourself. How do you feel about this person in the mirror? And how does the person in the mirror feel about you? And open up a welcoming dialogue. But I think that the listener's question is really important. We're learning how to do this within ourselves. Then we're needing to learn how to do it one-to-one. And then we're learning how to do it in a community. And I think these are three primary ways we all need to learn, because when we're one-to-one, there are certain fears, anxieties, and self-judgments we're learning how to overcome and be with and resolve and have the tools how to meet ourselves. When I'm with another, like you right now, my nervous system is processing a lot of information. Am I safe? Is this going to be a friendly dialogue? Are we going to have lunch together, or are you going to eat me for lunch? So we're in a whole mechanism in our nervous system that was cultured over thousands of years. Am I safe? Is this a safe moment with another? Mm-hmm. So I think we need to learn these tools one-to-one in a relationship. But then when we put ourselves in a group community situation, it even exacerbates those fears, concerns, again, at another level. And so I think we need to do it now within a group modality to help us learn how to feel safe no matter what's going on within or amongst a relationship or in a community around us. We're learning how to be responsive, not reactive. So when I'm working with on retreats or in trainings, I want people to do it, practice one-to-one on themselves, in a dyad,
and in a group.
It serves a purpose at each level.
Yeah, and for me, that's great. And you have the resources, so people can go to your website, and we have it on our website, mm-hmm. and they got the information. Also, you know, to answer the question is, if you have another parent or two parents or whatever that listen to this podcast can mm-hmm. start practicing. For me, the very first exercise you do, I think that can be something to work with for over a period of a few weeks, or, you know, to really start establishing that capacity.
Right, and I know when we're in relationship, say we're in a marriage or in a love relationship, and one or the other has a physical or a mental disability, or we have a child, this is such a crucial moment, because we can have differences of opinions, difference of how things should happen or whatever. And I think the first step is for each of us to really feel respected, heard, seen.
I love that.
So I talk about placing our cards face up on the table so we can see everything. And then we can begin to look at how can we find a way forward, even when we may have differences of opinions.
This is wonderful. No, I love that. I mean, there's something so evolved and humane in it, with simplicity and accessibility, that you don't have to go to the Himalayas and sit on the top of a mountain for 20 years. I mean, you can start it right here and now.
No, and I like that. It's very simple. It's not necessarily easy.
Yeah, and it's a practice.
Yeah.
One of the things is we're built to grow and evolve, and neurologically the same thing throughout life. However, it doesn't happen by itself. That means we need practices and intentionally spending the time and energy. I was just in New York with a friend from Israel who does, actually trained her, and she's now a trainer herself and all that stuff. But and she's also has a degree in physics and in mathematics and in environmental sciences. And we had this amazing conversation about the brain and, you know, entropy and negative entropy. And yes, Neil.
I have a request. We had a slight technical difficulty when Richard first asked you the question. So if you could just, because it was such a fundamental thing for both of you, just talk about safety once more and that's the place that you start.
Oh, okay. So, well, what I said is that when I start working with a child, I'll say it a little differently. I'm a stranger. A healthy brain is going to be a little suspicious, a little concerned. A child that has experienced trauma, lots of doctors, prodding, pain, the anxiety of the parents around them, they are more sensitive that way. So, and the parents come in and they go like, oh, this woman, and we heard, and it's expensive, and, you know, whatever. And the importance is for the child to be safe. So the parent has to be comfortable, and they sit in a chair and put some support in the back if necessary, whatever. And I might work with a child, the little ones in the lap of the parent for a period of a lesson, a few lessons, until they're happy to be on the table. They're mm-hmm. safe. I've had a child that had enormous trauma immediately after birth, where they did some surgery on the child without anesthesia. Terrible reaction on the part of the child. And he almost didn't look human to me. I didn't understand. I've never seen anything. Mm-hmm. Then I heard the story. I said, has anything happened to him? Really serious. For almost a year, I started working on him lying on the mother's stomach for probably 2-3 months. Then I could put him just next to her. Then I could put her a little away from him. It took a year. And that child did nothing. And he couldn't. It was horrible. And 7 years old, school, walking, everything. But it was a year.
So the underlying principle that both of you really believe in is safety has to come first. And for me, we have to feel safe inwardly with ourselves. And our emotions, our thoughts, our sensations need to feel safe, that they're safe in our hands. And we've often abused our emotions, trying to get rid of them, repressing them, suppressing them. So when they first come up, they're used to being repressed. So we're learning how to help our own nervous system feel safe in our hands. And it is something that I often ask in the first, second, or third time I'm with a person or a group. Take this statement and see what it resonates in you. I'm safe with myself. Because if we take that statement and we say it internally, I'm safe with myself, it's going to show us all the ways that I'm not safe with myself, where I betrayed myself, abandoned, repressed.
This is a beautiful process.
So to use these not as affirmations, I'm safe with myself.
No, as a discovery.
As a discovery. And
beautiful.
Until we have that deep sense of safety within ourselves, we're not going to be able to then give it to another. But when another really does feel that sense of safety, then that relaxation process really can begin.
This is beautiful. I really love that. We can do a whole podcast when I'm safe with myself, and then we can move it. I love myself, and then that'll be interesting. But but the thing is, when you say I'm safe with myself, I just repeating what you said. You find out the ways in which we create for ourselves the lack of safety, and then discover what it will take to have the safety.
Exactly. And
yeah, that's very beautiful.
And we have all these things. I'm safe with myself. I love myself. I'm willing to be heard. I'm willing to be seen. Each of these statements can evoke an inquiry where we begin to see, oh, I'm not really willing to be seen or to be heard. Or so we use them, again, not as affirmations, but as points of discovery to uncover how I haven't been safe with myself, so now we can recover a deep sense of safety with ourselves.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you, Neil, for making sure to keep us on track. he's glowing here on the side. He's just like happy. Yeah. That's so you're paralleling, which I really like that, what you're doing. And then when I touch the child, I see, and I let's say I look to start a certain movement. Let's say the child is on the back and I have my hand under their shoulder just to, you know, to move the shoulder a little forward to see what is connected to what dynamically, how the parts have been put themselves together. And I move as long as the response to my gentle force is there. That means that it generates movement. If it gives me pressure back, I stop because it's not organized to move.
So let me make the parallel with our emotions, our thoughts, or any body sensation. We're doing the same thing. We're, in a way, putting our hand on it gently, and we're just giving it a little nudge, and we're seeing how does it respond back. If it becomes more rigid, then I'm going to back off a little bit.
Yes.
If it starts to feel safe and nourished in my kind of approach to it, what I see is it begins to soften and begin to reveal more of what's underlying it.
Excellent. And then I can do any number of things at that point. One thing is I can stay in that place, but start to create a gentle variation. So let's say if I moved it in this direction, I might just change the angle by 1 or 2 degrees,
mm-hmm.
and just do, so I move into variations. I mean, I leave this original thing alone, like if you wanted to straighten the arm and it's spastic. And I start thinking that I might support it in doing what it's already doing and help it do what it's doing better. Because I'm looking for a brain that operates in a high-quality organization.
So in my language, I go with the defense or with the what is, because I know if I go with it, it'll often then come back in a whole different way.
Exactly.
And when I'm working with an inner emotion or when I'm working with someone who has an emotion, whether it's an adult or a child, I'm experimenting, like, where do you feel it in your body? How do you feel it? Is there a color, a shape, or a form to it? So I'm trying to find alternatives that go along with it and separate it out. Do you have a preference for this emotion to be here or not? Can we acknowledge the preference and now without the preference, again, meet the emotion? So it's like in a way you're doing it with the physical body, the nervous system.
And then what happens is, I very often, I know the kind of, it's so important, it's the complexity, it's the dynamic relationships. Shoulders don't move alone in space. Knees don't move alone in space. I mean, everything has to compute the whole body at all times, so it can compute it in more refined, free, complex ways that look just like more flexibility or something like that. Or it computed itself with fewer chunks because of whatever the limitations and constraints have been. So I might go and continue, quote unquote, working with the shoulder by doing things with the leg,
right,
or the pelvis. And then I come back to the shoulder and I see, has the brain used that information to reorganize and create new possibilities? And very often I would go and then all of a sudden the spastic hand will open. An arm will move that hasn't moved before.
So it's a holistic system, and that's the way I think of it. An emotion, a thought, a cognition, a memory, body sensation. It's the complexity of the whole body. I know that with whatever individual aspect I'm working with, it's in concert with the whole body.
Yeah.
So I'm always trying to include what's happening in other parts of the body. If we're having an emotion, is there a thought that goes with it? Is there a body sensation? So we look at the whole system and
utilize,
keep coming back to that underlying wholeness too.
Yeah, and utilize, because we are working with what it is. We're not working with our idea of how it's supposed to work. So the body, the brain has to integrate just under a tenth of a second, the whole brain. I mean, it's a system that has to become coherent. It's a self-organizing system. So we can take advantage of it by touching it from different directions and giving it the opportunity to do new stuff that it couldn't do before.
Right. And I'd love your comment on this, because I'm aware in my own sense that our nervous system is built to create expectations or anticipations of what we think we'd like or should be.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is always recognize that, honor that as part of our process, but how the should could become an imposition that gets in the way. So I want to acknowledge it and welcome it. And I call it welcoming it in the room as another character who's here, but let's not get caught in the should or the desire or the hope. Let's stay, as you're saying, with the what is, because we know experientially, if we stay with the what is, it will slowly open.
It's stay with what is and then move it about,
exactly.
You know. And I think that's because we're almost at the end. So
staying with what is not a passive process. It's
yes.
a very active
Yeah, active.
Process.
And then for me, is then, you know, I literally provide opportunities and elements of information or experiences or so
yes.
on.
Yeah.
But I think this is so important. What I'm taking from it, which I love what you said, is that when you do that, and you said it earlier in the interview, it does might not seem like it, but it opens a world of possibilities that otherwise are really not going to manifest.
Yeah.
So I think for, again, parents and mm-hmm. people who are going through difficulty themselves, is that all that you have spoken and presented, and I know there's so much more that you do, so people, you'll say your website address in a second, that there are out there tremendous number of possibilities. I don't know what they are. I don't go in saying, oh, there's that possibility and we're going to hit that, because I wouldn't know how to do it. I go and I say, I'm going to go into the cookie jar of possibilities. This amazing, and let's see what emerges.
And I know when you're doing that, you're stepping out of what I said was the default network into the present-centered network in our brain that opens us to this infinite of possibilities, where we're open to the unknown and we're willing to receive that information.
Yeah. So I mean, as you are saying, always at the presence of the unknown and the possibilities, that the fact that I don't know them is because they have not manifested yet, and we can't know them in advance.
And
that is so important to know.
And I think this is easy to say, not always easy to embody. This, I'm open to the unknown. I'm willing to be open to not knowing.
Yeah, but then, what I like about what you do that at the same time you give tools to work with, so that you're not just like, you know, like you said, passive, open to the unknown, because probably not much good will happen on
no,
that.
No, and it is the person who doesn't know what to do who's in trouble. That's why we want to teach the tools that develop these skillful means. And as we're also opening to this ability to hold openness and unknowingness, but having the tools, absolutely.
And bringing it kind of, because you and I can start talking here and here and here and kind of fly off.
That's why I want to keep the ground in the wholeness of being.
But the thing is that the thing I think that's so important, and I want to say it about to the parents, and one of the things that I discovered that I was facilitating for the parents early on, unexpected to on my part, is that I don't love the kids of Pucci Mucci like that, but I'm
it's a on deep their part, side.
It's a
deep heart connection.
Yeah. And I'm free to love the child. It doesn't matter how they show up. I'm free to love the child. And parents that have been exposed, we need to finish in a second, parents have been exposed to so much diagnosis and prognosis and daily disappointments, and what you were showing and starting to teach today gives the tools and gives the permission to love your child totally as they are now and as they're going to become. And
yeah.
That, I think, is the biggest gift. Could you say the website where they could go?
Sure. Irest.org, IREST.org, like resting back. So Irest.org is our nonprofit. And you can see that we have all of our trainings online and in-person events. And we also have different downloads. Some are free, some are for purchase, where you can gain access to these different tools and things
Beautiful.
That we've been talking about today.
Thank you so much. What an honor to have you. And I love, I just learn when I'm sitting next to you.
We just like to be together. Come
on. Okay. All right. I'll admit to that.
this is our fun.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much. And thank you guys for being with us and for listening to us. And those of you who listen to it later, thank you for coming on and listening to this wonderful, wonderful man, Dr. Richard Miller, whose life's work is fantastic. It's a huge gift to us.
And thank you, Annette.
Thank you.
Yeah. Blessings.
Thank you for joining us on Neuro Movement Revolution with Annette Benyel. You will find all of our podcasts and additional resources on our website at www.annettebenyelmethod.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. We look forward to seeing you online for our next Neuro Movement Revolution.